Okay, it's the structuralism seminar. Say hello to your colleagues.
Hello.
That's nice, isn't it? That was. They all sound a bit exhausted because they've just gone to the wrong seminar room and they've had to run over here. Right, structuralism. So here on the first slide, we've got the picture of Ferdinand de Saussure, the founding father of structuralist linguistics. And I think probably, maybe there are two things to say about Saussure at this stage. Well, maybe three. I mean, one is there is a chapter, actually, in the book Social Semiotics by Hodge and Kress on the founding fathers of semiotic theory. Because that book is a new form of semiotic theory, so they kind of look back and say, where did it all come from? And they do a kind of critique of some of the early big figures in semiotic theory. So they do a critique of Saussure, which we may come back to a little bit later. So it's worth reading that chapter. It's called something like The Founding Fathers. I mean, it's terribly patriarchal, I'm afraid. They are all founding fathers, unfortunately. They're all men. The other thing that's usually said about Saussure is that this is a particular European tradition that comes out of European linguistics, and there is an American tradition which is rather different, and the founding father who's usually referred to in that tradition is Charles Sanders Peirce, who has a rather different kind of model. We won't look at Peirce. So has anybody done Peirce? The Peircean triad? Okay. I'll just do this briefly, okay? Because it's of academic interest. I don't know if it's of practical interest to you, but we'll see where we go. So for Saussure, there is an idea in his book, The Course in General Linguistics, that the sign is arbitrary, you know? So he says that it's just a matter of human convention that the one signifier stands for one signified. So the fact that we use the word tree for the tall woody thing with things sticking out of it is arbitrary. If we were French, we would use the word arbre, and so on. Every language has a different word for tree. So that's his argument. You could use any word. It wouldn't matter. As long as everybody agrees that that's the signifier for that idea, then it works. Okay? Now, several people have kind of argued with this afterwards and said, well, is it really completely arbitrary? You know, for one thing, I mean, there is a history of these words that goes all the way back through time. And if you look at the kind of origins of language, or if you look at how children learn language growing up, you realise that some words actually do kind of have a motivated meaning. A word like mother, you know. I mean, most languages have a word for mother that involves that soft kind of sound. And so you could argue, well, maybe that is kind of motivated. The sound sounds like the thing that's being represented. Or maybe there's a historical reason which is motivated. The social semioticians completely oppose this. I mean, they say the sign is always motivated because every time a sign maker decides to make a mark on a piece of paper or make some speech come out of their mouth or apply a brush to canvas or a chisel to stone, they are at that point making a decision. What signifying material is appropriate for the meaning that I want to make? So for them, the sign is socially motivated, and that's the most important thing about it. So you get this kind of argument, you know, is language and semiotics entirely arbitrary? You could use any old signifier as long as everyone agrees. Or is it motivated by social purpose, history, appropriateness of the signifier to the thing it's representing, or whatever? What Peirce does is seems to me slightly more commonsensical, actually. He says there's like a continuum of arbitrariness. And at one end, you get an icon, he says, which is a picture of what it's supposed to be. Okay, so if you want a tree, you have a picture of a tree. In the middle, he has a thing which is called an indexical sign, which he says is like a pointing sign. So this is a bit like a traffic symbol that says, you know, turn right at the next junction. Okay, it's kind of abstract, but it's pointing towards another meaning. And at the far extreme, he says you have a symbol where you decide that a rose stands for the idea of love. And that's not at all obvious. So he has a kind of continuum of arbitrariness. That's his idea. So it's worth kind of checking out the American tradition a little bit as well. And this argument about arbitrariness and social motivation is one that we'll come back to when we talk about social semiotics. Is that okay so far? Yeah, Robert, go on.
So are you using arbitrary and motivated as opposite?
Yes, exactly. I know that's kind of not obvious or instinctive, but that's the sort of language they use. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can use motivated and unmotivated as similar opposites. So unmotivated would equal arbitrary. Yeah, yeah.
But there are people who are making it arbitrary, so it's always socially motivated.
I know, it's a slightly false argument, actually. It is a slightly phony argument, because they mean different things by it, but... You know, I think it's partly a kind of philosophical thing. I mean, it sounds very technical, but actually I think it's really about the sort of spirit of the enterprise. You know, so for Saussure, it was a formal academic study. I mean, it was a disinterested academic formal study of language. For the social semioticians, it's a kind of committed political project, you know, where social motivation, why people are motivated to make the signs they do, and what power they have to make those signs within, you know, a much bigger system of power relations, that's what they're interested in. So, you know, it's about a difference of purpose, really, I think. You can somehow manage to agree with both of them, you know, if you... Okay, let's have a look at some of Saussure's famous kind of binary opposites, which a couple of you have mentioned. And what I'm going to ask you to do with these is kind of apply them. So our kind of activity today is we're going to apply these binary opposites and try and work out what they mean. And I will refer you back again to Hodge and Cress's chapter on the Founding Fathers, because one of their techniques for critiquing Saussure is to unpick these. They call it something like Saussure's rubbish bin, because their point is in each of these, or in several of these binary opposites, Saussure goes for one and says, let's put the other one aside for the moment. And you'll see, and they say, no, let's bring it back into the field. I'll say what I mean as we go through. The first one, signifier and signified, obviously this is kind of at the basis of all semiotics. In what sense does signifying material stand for a concept, an idea, or a referent in the real world? I mean, there's always a bit of sort of disagreement about this, you know. So some semioticians will say, well, you know, it's not the cup itself that the signifier is referring to, it's the idea of the cup, you know, in your mind. But obviously there's kind of also relationships between different signifying systems. You know, how does a picture of a cup relate to the word cup, relate to the idea of the cup in your mind, you know, and so on. So in any case, this relationship, complex relationship between signifier material and signified, is important. Another kind of additional layer of complexity is imported in social semiotics, who make a distinction between mode and medium, and we'll come back to this maybe with Gunther later in the term. Their argument is that semiotics and linguistics are traditionally quite abstract disciplines, so they deal with abstract signifying systems, words, and the grammar of images. And for them, that's the important thing. What isn't important is the physical material which the sign is made out of. So, you know, whether your word is printed on perfumed lavender paper or toilet paper doesn't make any difference to them. Okay? Whether your photograph is printed on matte paper or glossy paper makes no difference to them. But they say, actually, the material medium is important and it does change the meaning. In some cases, it very obviously changes the meaning. You know, if Michelangelo decides to make a statue out of Carrara marble instead of a statue out of granite, that makes a difference to the meaning of the statue. And their favourite contemporary example is the matte and glossy photograph. You know, does it make a difference? Yes, it makes a difference. What's the difference between a matte and glossy paper?
Shiny and rough.
Shiny and rough, okay. If you're a professional photographer, would you choose matte or would you choose glossy?
Matte.
Yeah, why? So why do professional photographers go for matte?
It kind of represents more of a realistic approach.
I think there is something, and that's why they use black and white as well, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of claim to documentary realism on the one hand, but also a kind of claim to artistic status, would you agree? Yeah, okay, it's a kind of quality thing. It used to be completely the opposite. I mean, originally glossy was very expensive and only the best photographs would be glossy. So then that was the high status one, but now the glossy is cheap. It's inverted. So anyway, it's only a small example, but their argument is that material medium contributes to the semiotic significance. Okay, second one, langue and parole. I'm practicing my French accent here. So for them, langue is the big system of language or whatever it might be, and parole is the specific utterance. And this is where Hodge and Kress's dustbin comes into play, because they argue that Saussure made a specific decision. He was going to look at the big system, and he wasn't going to look at specific utterances in social context, whereas sociolinguistics, for instance, does the opposite. It looks at utterances in context. Their argument, Hodge and Kress, is you need to do both if you're going to get the whole picture. You need to know what system the speaker or the sign maker is drawing on, and you need to know why they're making those specific decisions at that particular moment in that particular context. So they argue that you keep them both. Diachronic and synchronic. Okay, diachronic is across time, and synchronic is one moment in time, at the same time. So again, as in the previous one, you can have historical linguistics, diachronic linguistics, which looks at how language develops and evolves, or you can have synchronic linguistics, which looks at how language is used at a particular moment in time, usually in a sort of empirical study of a particular population. Okay, same with semiotics. And again, Hodge and Kress say that Saussure kind of went for the former, put the latter aside, and their argument is you need to do both. Syntarm and paradigm. These are usually referred to as the axis of selection. Other way around, actually. I should have put paradigm first. Paradigm is the axis of selection, and syntarm is the axis of combination. So if you think of language again as the example, paradigm would be the types of semiotic object that we can select from. So if you were thinking of making up a sentence, you might want a noun, it's one type of paradigm, a verb, another type of paradigm, another noun to make up a sentence that says somebody's doing something to somebody else. That's very abstract. I mean, suppose I was more specific and I was going to write a superhero story. Okay? Now, I know that my protagonist is going to be a superhero, but immediately I've got a choice: do I have a male superhero or a female superhero? So I've got a gender paradigm to choose from as well. Okay? And the verb, you know, what's my first action going to be? So always you're making choices, and a kind of trick in semiotics is to kind of conduct what they call a kind of substitution exercise. So if you're thinking about something in your text that you're analysing and you want to think, well, how would it be different? Sorry, what's beeping? I thought it was this. If you're thinking, how would it be different if a different paradigm had been chosen, then you can substitute it. You can say, well, how would this story be different if it was a female superhero instead of a male superhero, or a black superhero instead of a white superhero? So you can do a semiotic substitution. It is this, isn't it? It's got an alarmingly flashing red light on it. Hello, part-timers. My podcast machine might be about to go down, but you may get a partial podcast, but we'll keep going.